On this edition of Jazz Profiles, it's a tribute to the late alto saxophonist Jackie McLean. He passed away in March 2006 at the age of 75.
Jackie's approach was just all about swing, about making them toes tap.
When he plays, he gets the shoulder goes up and he gets this stance that's like he looks like he's planted like a tree right into the earth, and he just gets that nice big full sound out of the alto that nobody else gets but him.
For me, the most inspiration thing about Jackie is that he dares to improvise. You know, there's a lot of cats who play solos that aren't improvising.
Jackie McLean isn't known as an innovator. No trends or controversies grew up around his work. Yet in nearly six decades as a musician, he's constantly sought out new terrain. McLean grew up with Sonny Rollins. He had Bud Powell as a mentor and shared saxophones with Charlie Parker. He was educated by Miles Davis and challenged by Charles Mingus. In the process, Jackie McLean has evolved into one of the most distinctive alto saxophone voices in jazz. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles. On this show, Jackie McLean's Jazz in the Fast Lane. The sound of Jackie McLean is instantly recognizable, swirling with the grace of an arabesque and the terse authority of a jackhammer. It's a sound that's readily apparent to longtime McLean associates like pianist Walter Bishop Jr.
Oh, the thing about Jackie, he always plays with a sense of urgency, like he's always on the edge. You know, like every performance could be his last.
Jazz critic Ira Gittler.
It had that edge and a certain slashing quality. I once wrote a line, he can cut a hole in your heart and let the night pour in.
The first thing you're likely to hear when you open the door of Jackie McLean's Hartford, Connecticut home is the sound of the alto saxophone. Even at this stage of his career, he still practices.
He practices religiously.
Jackie McLean's son, Renee, has heard this sound since he was born.
You can hardly get him away from the instrument. That's all he lives to do. I think my mom has put up with it all these years. You know, you can't get a word in edgewise. He'll come down from up in his room, have something to eat, and go right back up, and he'll be at it again. And even if he doesn't have the instrument in his hand, the music is always going on in his head.
Jackie McLean really doesn't need to polish his technique. Right now, he's just breaking in an alto saxophone he's had refurbished. But usually, when Jackie McLean practices, he's doing something he and his colleagues have done for 5 decades of jazz, looking for something new.
Well, we were trying to play something different. You know, we weren't trying to just regurgitate and repeat what had gone on before. You know, nobody can do what Miles does better than Miles, and certainly nobody can do what Charlie Parker did better than Bird.
Jackie McLean has endured the rigors of jazz life in New York City, including a long affair with heroin. But his music has never faltered, never lost the spark that was ignited in New York City, where he was born on May 17, 1931, as John Linwood McLean. He was surrounded by family and music, growing up in the Sugar Hill neighborhood of Harlem.
I loved the music. I heard the big bands during the early 40s, and I guess even the late 30s, Charlie Barnett, Duke Ellington. These are the bands that came to the Apollo Theater, Lionel Hampton, all these great bands.
The sound that truly seduced Jackie McLean was the saxophone. He got his first one from his godfather, Norman Cobb, who played in the Abyssinian Baptist Church Band.
He played soprano saxophone in the church band on Sunday, and I went to church with him every Sunday and sat in that pit, so I was close to the instrument. So when I got to be 13, I knew he had 2 soprano saxophones, 2 straight sopranos. And I asked him, could he show me how to play the saxophone, and he gave me his silver one. And so thus I began playing the soprano saxophone.
As a teenager, Jackie McLean was immersed in music. The Sugar Hill neighborhood was home to many veteran musicians in the 30s and 40s, including Duke Ellington and Don Redman. And there were younger musicians as well. McLean learned how to play his horn from Andy Kirk Jr., son of the famous Andy Kirk from the Clouds of Joy. He hung out in the square with saxophonist Sonny Rollins, drummer Art Taylor, and pianist Kenny Drew and Gil Coggins. They were all within a subway ride of 52nd Street, the mecca of the modern jazz movement called bebop. Ira Gittler.
The advantage they had over musicians who came to New York from other places later in the 50s, they listened to Charlie Parker on record. Jackie and his cohorts listened to Charlie Parker on record, but also had the opportunity to hear Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Bud Powell and all these people firsthand.
As a teen, Jackie worked in his stepfather's record store at 143rd and 8th Streets and got to hear the latest jazz sides. But the first musician to really capture his imagination was tenor saxophonist Lester Young.
When I heard Lester Young, that really had an impression on me. It seemed as though he was playing to me. You know, it seemed as though his instrument was speaking to me personally.
For his 15th birthday, Jackie's mother bought him an alto saxophone. But it wasn't the sound that McLean heard in his head.
I tried to play the alto like Lester Young, and my stepfather used to say to me all the time, that's not the way that instrument is supposed to be played. And he would put on Johnny Hodges or Willie Smith, and I'd listen to those guys, and as much as I wanted to love it, I really didn't. I really loved still Lester Young, you know, and Dexter Gordon and these tenor players. So one day, I opened a box of records. It was a yellow label, a Continental recording called Sorta Kinda. On one side, on the other side, was called Seventh Avenue. It was by Trummy Young and his band.
Everybody knows I kinda like you. Could you sorta kinda like me too? I wanna hold you in my arms and say, sorta kinda like you more each day.
So we put on the record, and after the vocal is over, and then there's a trombone solo, then I hear this trumpet solo that caught my ear. Right after the trumpet solo, here came this alto.
First
time in the history of my life, I heard the alto saxophone, and I loved it. I loved the way it sounded, the quality. I liked the ideas. And so when the record was over, I looked on there, and the name was Charlie Parker.
Jackie devoured every record and bit of musical information he could find on one of the founders of bebop. But Charlie Parker wasn't his only influence. One day, he was working in the record store, playing a side by pianist Bud Powell, when he was approached by a young man. The young man claimed to be Powell's brother, Richard. McLean didn't believe him.
He said, oh yeah, he said, my brother's coming home Sunday from the hospital. If you don't believe me, I'll come around here and get you and take you over there and show you that he's my brother. And sure enough, that Sunday, Richard came to the record shop and I closed up the shop, locked it up and went around the corner with my horn in my hand and went in and met Bud for the first time. Of course, I didn't even know it was Bud Powell when he introduced me to him because I had never seen Bud. But there was a piano in the room and Bud stepped out of his room and said, you don't believe I'm Bud Powell? And I said, I don't know, you know. Then he stepped over to the piano and began to play it. That's when I knew it was him.
Bud Powell playing Somebody Loves Me. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Jackie McLean.
Jackie began visiting with Bud Powell on a regular basis, learning new tunes and absorbing the rudiments of bebop from another of its architects.
I went to Bud's house religiously for the next 2.5 years, you know, on a weekly basis, a couple of days a week, and between that and going to school and hearing other music around and listening to the records, I began to develop very fast, you know.
So fast that Bud Powell invited him up on stage at Birdland. In the audience was Ira Gittler.
I heard his debut at Birdland. He and a trumpeter named Lowell Lewis in the famous Sugar Hill neighborhood came down, and Bud Powell invited them to sit in with him at Birdland. I happened to be there that night, and that was his debut in the big time.
After this auspicious beginning, Bud Powell sent McLean to trumpeter Miles Davis.
Bud told Miles that he would send him down somebody to sit in with him, and I went down and played with Miles, and right after that I went with his band, and I was only playing 4 years at that time. So it was incredible, and I think that my concept and my development accelerated fast because I was in Bud's company and I heard him play so much, and the music was going right into my mental computer, you know, into my brain. And I think that helped me to develop very fast.
At the age of 19, Jackie McLean made his first jazz recording. It was a 1951 session with trumpeter Miles Davis. The young musician sat next to drummer Art Blakey, pianist Walter Bishop Jr., bassist Tommy Potter, and tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins on a record that many people consider to be the opening shot of a style called hard bop. The album was named Dig.
That was a big day for me, and it was ironic that all of the characters that would later be in my life came through that studio that day. That's the first day I met Mingus. He dropped through that studio. I had never met him or seen him before, and for some reason, he came up to that studio while we were taking our instruments out and walked through, and Art Blakey was playing drums on that date, and I would later play in his band. And of course, Charlie Parker was in the studio that day, and I was so sorry that he was there because it made me so nervous, the fact that he was just there that day, you know. But Bird was very kind again, calmed me down, talked to me, and helped me that day to get through that session, you know.
Track from Dig by Miles Davis with Jackie McLean on alto saxophone. Although the composition Dig was mistakenly credited to Miles Davis, everyone in the jazz community knew it was written by Jackie McLean. As a result of this session with Miles, Jackie moved to the head of the pack as Charlie Parker's heir apparent. Bird himself anointed McLean at a performance that even Miles Davis said put the saxophonist on the map. Jackie McLean.
I was playing with Miles in Birdland, and I remember vividly that Bird came in with his wife, Chan, and sat right on the front table in front of the bandstand, and the place was packed. And every solo I played, he was just clapping, and then when I came off the stage, he came over and hugged me and kissed me on the cheek, and yeah, it was an important night for me.
Jackie McLean, playing with Miles Davis on Denial. McLean recorded his first album as a leader in 1956 on the Ad-Lib label. He then moved on to Prestige Records, where he cut a series of hard-driving, blowing sessions that solidified his reputation. Ira Gittler.
I was excited by the fact that this young musician was commanding kind of presence. Not that he was fully formed. He, obviously was indebted to Charlie Parker, but this was kind of the first impression you got with him. The more you listened to him, you realized there were other influences coming out. I was impressed with him, and both by his youth and away from the youth, just as a player who I thought was going to be something. And the passion was always there.
Jackie McLean playing Ending from his 1956 album, Lights Out. 1956 was the same year that Jackie began working with Charles Mingus, who lit the first ember of McLean's changing sound. That's just ahead. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to Jazz Profiles. Jackie McLean's Jazz in the Fast Lane from NPR, National Public Radio. Throughout the 1950s, Jackie McLean's saxophone playing always drew comparisons to Charlie Parker. That began to change when he joined up with bassist and composer Charles Mingus. Mingus was already moving away from the strictures of bebop, creating long-form compositions that shared an orchestral sensibility with Duke Ellington, but with the improvisational flair of a small band. Jackie says that Mingus had a simple way of making him think beyond Bird.
By putting me down whenever I quoted Bird, in a solo or something, he would say, look, man, the Bird already played that, recorded that. Everybody knows that's Bird's stuff you're playing, man. Why don't you play your own stuff? You have your own sound. Why don't you play your own ideas? Try to be Jackie McLean. Quit trying to be Charlie Parker.
Charles Mingus's Pithecanthropus erectus with Jackie McLean on alto saxophone. McLean spent a couple of years with Mingus, but the bassist was a difficult band leader to work with. After months of tension, bad pay, and lousy hotels, Jackie decided to leave the group. His departure from the band almost ended in tragedy when he served notice in a Cleveland club.
We were leaving the stage after a set. So as Charlie was leaving, I said, "Charlie, I want to speak to you for a minute." And he turned around and said, "Yeah, what is it?" I said, "Look, I want to give you my notice, you know, for a 2-week notice if I can, because," and before I could say anything, you know, he hauled off and hit me in the mouth, you know. When I touched my mouth and saw the blood and felt my teeth were knocked back, you know, it infuriated me, and I pulled my knife and tried to stab him, you know. And if it hadn't been for Willie Jones, the drummer, and the bartender grabbing my arm, I might have killed Charlie that night. And I'm so glad and thank God that they were there to grab my arm, because the knife didn't go in that deep. It just went, just cut his skin, basically.
Despite the severity of the incident, Mingus invited Jackie back into the group, and he returned. But it wasn't long before he left again to join the Jazz Messengers, led by one of Jackie's childhood heroes, drummer Art Blakey. Unlike Mingus's complicated scores, Blakey played with a brand of hard bop rooted in blowing sessions.
It was blowing, but it was organized, very organized. And he had his arrangements in his mind that he wanted, and he never wrote anything down because he wasn't that kind of a musician, but he would sing it to us, you know. He said, "Jackie, I want you to do this," and he'd sing exactly what he wanted me to do, and I would pick it out, trumpet, what I want you to do, tell the rhythm section, and it would be an arrangement by Art Blakey.
Played by Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers with Jackie McLean, Johnny Griffin on tenor, and Bill Hardman playing trumpet. Throughout much of the late 40s and early 50s, and like several of his colleagues during this period, Jackie was hampered by an addiction to heroin. He was eventually busted, thrown in prison for 6 months, and he lost his cabaret card, that all-important requirement if you wanted to play jazz clubs in New York City. His addiction remains a dark corner in his life.
I don't like to talk about that because that's something that's in my past, and it's like waking up a monster constantly to talk about something that brought such sorrow to my life and such trauma to my life. It's enough to say that I was once addicted to heroin, and I got myself together and shut the door on it, and that's the end of it. There's nothing to talk about.
Jazz critic Ira Gittler was aware of McLean's addiction, but he says he never saw it affect him on stage.
He wasn't really, like, nodding on the bandstand. You knew he was strung out because you knew him and you knew what he was going through. I know Miles has some description in his book of Jackie going in the alley and throwing up or something like that, but, you know, that was in the alley. That wasn't on the bandstand.
Because McLean often couldn't play in most New York City clubs, Jackie had to find other venues for his music. One of the most fortuitous was a play called The Connection. Ironically, the play is about a group of men sitting in an apartment being filmed for a documentary while they wait for a drug connection. A jazz quartet led by pianist Freddie Redd is also there waiting. Jackie became part of the ensemble as a musician and an actor.
It was a role he'd been rehearsing most of his life.
See, I've told you over and over again, I'm not interested in making a Hollywood picture.
Nice. We're going Hollywood.
No, come on now. Will you stop that? Will you please just stop that? See, I know something about Eisenstein and Flaherty. You know? Well, JJ, you better cut because this has got to be settled right now.
Hey, JJ. You sure have changed since Harlem, man.
So have you, Jackie.
I'm my own man. Is your name going to be on this film?
Playwright Jack Gelber said he wanted something more realistic than the depiction seen in drug films such as Man with the Golden Arm.
I wrote a play in which I tried to incorporate jazz into as part of the fabric of the play. There had been a number of movies at that moment, a couple of plays, that I thought were sort of living lies about heroin and jazz, and somehow I thought I could set the record straight.
Well, we were trying to make it as authentic as we possibly could, you know. We were trying to make it authentic at that time. And some of us had those problems, and so therefore that did make it authentic, yeah.
The musicians actually played during the performance, as if they were simply hanging around, waiting for their connection, jamming.
Me too. I feel like playing something. Give our guests a little background.
Freddie Redd's Who Killed Cock Robin, from his soundtrack to The Connection with Jackie McLean on alto saxophone. Jackie acted off and on in The Connection until 1964 and appeared in the filmed version. While he was performing in The Connection, jazz was undergoing a change. Saxophonist Ornette Coleman, composer Sun Ra, and pianist Cecil Taylor had arrived in New York City and were challenging the music in a new and sometimes controversial fashion. Still a young man, just into his 30s, Jackie was enthralled by these new sounds. Ira Gittler.
Whether or not you liked Ornette Coleman or any of the other avant players, something of what was in the air rubbed off on all the players and caused them to do their own new thing, so to speak. But Jackie was quite actively interested in the new things happening in the music.
Now, I heard Sun Ra in 1957, and that really kind of turned my head around. He and Mingus had a great deal of influence on me, and Cecil Taylor as well. And so it was when I heard Ornette, I mean, he was the first saxophone player that I heard that stepped into that room, the big room of freedom, you know.
Jackie McLean and Ornette Coleman recorded together on the album New and Old Gospel. But it was with his own group that he truly forged a union between the avant-garde and bebop. Albums such as Destination Out signaled a new course for the veteran player. Trombonist Gratian Moncourt III wrote several of the band's compositions between 1962 and 1964. Moncourt remembers the first performances of McLean's new sound in a group that included Bobby Hutcherson on vibes, Eddie Kahn on bass, and a young drummer named Tony Williams.
I think we were supposed to open up for one weekend. But the funny part about it was the group really caught on like wildfire. All the musicians started talking about the new sound that Jackie had developed. Before I know it, it looked like every musician in the world came through to check us out, and the place stayed packed. But to tell you the truth, the club owners hated us because they couldn't stand the music we were playing, you know? But they couldn't fire us because we packed the house, the business was really good. And we went in for 1 week, and we stayed for four.
Playing Gratian Moncourt III's Frankenstein from the album One Step Beyond. McLean's new music often sounded free of harmonic structure and chord changes, but Moncourt says that's not the case.
We were playing on changes, it's just that the changes were different. They were not standard traditional changes, and that's what really made the music sound very odd, and it might have given the impression that we were playing free because the harmonic patterns were not familiar.
It wasn't just honking and squeaking on the saxophone.
Drummer Jack DeJohnette, who got his first major jazz gig with Jackie McLean.
It was always had some melody, had some direction, had a purpose to it.
Jackie McLean playing Jack DeJohnette's Climax with DeJohnette on drums and Lee Morgan trumpet. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Jackie McLean. Jackie McLean's sound wasn't just an evolution from his work with Charles Mingus and the influence of Sun Ra and Ornette Coleman. It was also an expression of the political unrest of the 60s. His 1963 album, Let Freedom Ring, was both a musical and social statement.
There was double meaning to Let Freedom Ring. I had just left Washington, and Martin Luther King had just made that speech, I Have a Dream, and Let Freedom Ring, and I came back to New York, and the music that I was playing, it was a time of turmoil. It was the beginning of a very horrible decade in the history of America. It was a time of musicians really reflecting through their music what their life was like in America at that particular time, and so it did have an effect on the music, and so that's what my music was about. It was about living in that particular decade at that time.
Jackie McLean's Melody for Melanie from Let Freedom Ring. McLean has always shown a penchant for discovering new drummers. He gave Michael Carvin, Lenny White, and Carl Allen some of their first jobs. Jack DeJohnette and Tony Williams played with the saxophonist before Miles Davis stole them away. Jackie says he has a special insight into rhythm because he plays the saxophone like a drum.
That's true. And the saxophone is a drum to me. And it's a percussive instrument, albeit it's melodic, you know, and I play from a whole melodic perspective and conception. But the saxophone is a drum, basically, because basically that's what I am, a drummer.
Jackie McLean made several albums in the 1970s, including a pair with tenor saxophonist Dexter Gordon. At the same time, he was also teaching at the University of Hartford. He came to the university in 1968 and founded the African American Music Department, which he chairs. At the same time, in 1970, he and his wife Dolly founded the Artist Collective, a community-based arts education institution. Like many jazz musicians, McLean found sanctuary in academia, and between 1978 and 1988, made only one recording.
You know, I'm always a musician. That's what I do, and what I teach is about the music, so it's not like really going anywhere. I'm just elaborating on it more and organizing it and presenting it for an educational environment. You know, I'm sitting there talking to the students about what happened in my life, what happened in other people's lives. But I had to go back and do a lot of research, find out about a lot of musicians that I never even knew anything about, people like Jelly Roll Morton and James Reese Europe and so many, you know, that it was an awakening for me. And it went hand in hand with what I was trying to do on the instrument.
McLean's imprint is evident on the artists who have passed through his classes. Billy and Winard Harper, Donald Harrison, Abraham Burton, Cindy Blackman, and Antoine Roney are all former students. Probably the most important student of all is his son, Renee. Jackie's three children have all played music, but it's Renee, born in 1947, who still plays professionally. It wasn't long before he was part of his father's group. Dance Little Mandiza, written by Renee McLean and played by the father and son saxophone duo of Renee and Jackie McLean.
When you listen to Jackie play, it didn't take away from that bird lineage. It added to it, you know.
Trumpeter Charles Tolliver played with McLean in the mid-60s.
Jackie had that way of, he'd drop in a phrase that, you know, lets you know, hey, you know, Bird is still alive and well.
The revolutionary zeal of Charlie Parker and the bebop movement still lives within him, and he's expanding it in new directions for generations to come.
I definitely hear an amazing, mature musician, but I hear a searching player, you know?
Saxophonist Joe Lovano, who appeared on a McLean tribute album called Jackie's Blues Bag.
To me, he sounds fresher and younger than a lot of the cats who are younger in age, because he's an improviser and he plays with an inspired sound and approach.
Our tribute to Jackie McLean, Jazz in the Fast Lane, was written, produced, and mixed by John DeLaBerry. Special thanks to Magic Fire Video, distributors of The Connection, Don Lukoff and Terry Hinton. Additional thanks to Dolly McLean and Kimberly Hoff. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. Website coordinator, Bettina Owens. The executive producers are Mary Beth Kirshner and Murray Horwitz. To email us or get more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Yeah, Jack.
I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've been listening to a tribute to the late alto saxophonist Jackie McLean. He passed away in March 2006 at the age of 75. Discover more great jazz at NPR Music, including our new series, Live at the Village Vanguard, live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.